Welcome to day 123 of our 180-day study of the Westminster Standards. We're in the Sixth Commandment. Yesterday, we started looking at the sins forbidden in the Sixth Commandment. The Westminster Shorter Catechism, question 69, says, "What is forbidden in the Sixth Commandment?" and answers, "The Sixth Commandment forbiddeth the taking away of our own life or the life of our neighbor unjustly, or whatsoever tendeth thereunto." The Larger Catechism, question 136, asks, "What are the sins forbidden in the Sixth Commandment?" and answers, "The sins forbidden in the Sixth Commandment are all taking away the life of ourselves or of others, except in case of public justice, lawful war, or necessary defense." Now, and you can see the rest of the answer there on the blog post. Yesterday we started looking at public justice. That's capital punishment. And we took a whole day to look at capital punishment. Today we're going to start looking at lawful war, and we might just take 2 days to look at lawful war. Why are we spending so much time on this? I guess maybe that's just my own personal priorities of what I think is important, but let me try to convince you that it is worth our looking at in some detail. Last year in America, there were over 10,000 people who were murdered, and that's, of course, abhorrent. But what is more staggering is that during the 20th century, 10,000 human beings were intentionally killed each and every single day by the institution which is supposedly entrusted with protecting us from murderers. And that this is the extraordinary thing about why I think the Westminster Standards have so tragically erred on this point. And that is that when they speak of lawful war and public justice, what they're speaking of is the civil magistrate. There's great deference paid to the civil magistrate in the Westminster Standards. But it's the civil magistrate that has been the most purposeful and engaged in orchestrated killing. And so in a spirit of the Shorter Catechism, which says the Sixth Commandment forbids not just taking away our life or our neighbor's life unjustly, but anything that tends to take away life should be viewed with great skepticism at the least. We have to ask, what is the tendency of this institution? What is the tendency of this idea of public justice? What is the tendency of this idea of lawful war? What is the idea, well, what is the tendency of the concept and the execution of purposeful, intentional, systematic killing? Because that's what the civil magistrate does, and especially in war, intentional, orchestrated, deliberate killing. Now, somewhere between 50 and 90 million human beings were killed in World War II. Who won World War II? Did the United States win World War II? Well, I think the best judge of who the winner of a war is who ends up with the most chips, who ends up with the most property, who ends up with the most slaves, the most citizens, the most new conscripts, the new additions to its jurisdiction. And with that standard, the clear winner of World War II was Marxism or communism. Marxism was awarded at the end of the war Eastern Europe, and eventually in the next 5 or 10 years, Asia. 1 billion people were brought under the subjection of communism as a result of World War II. We kept the greatest enemy of communism, that is to say, the United States, prevented the greatest enemy of communism from destroying communism, and that, of course, was Nazism. National socialism in Germany was the greatest threat to international socialism in the Soviet Union, and the United States came down on the side of Marxist socialism or communism. Would Moses or Isaiah or Jesus have considered the wars of the last 200 years that the United States has participated in to be godly, lawful wars? And how about the wars we're seeing in the 20th century? And what should Christians do about, what should those who have studied the Westminster Standards do about all these wars? That's the question we're asking, and that's why we're spending a couple of days to look at lawful war. Let's review. Yesterday we talked about capital punishment, which is not the biblical name for it. Actually, the theme of what they call capital punishment or public justice is atonement. It's blood. It's the shedding of blood to make atonement. Recall in Genesis 8, actually, Noah gets off the ark, he builds an altar, starts doing burnt offerings, shedding the blood of animals to make atonement. And he's told then in chapter 9 that anyone who sheds blood, his blood has to be shed. Numbers 35 is cited in the sixth commandment as one of these exceptions, public justice, that says, which what the verse says is that atonement has to be made for the land because the land is defiled by the blood that shed it. And only the blood of him that shed the blood can make atonement. The animals at the altar that Noah built won't do the trick. We saw Deuteronomy 21, which says that if you have an unsolved homicide, that you're to take a heifer, slit its throat, and its blood will cleanse the land or make atonement for the land for the shedding of innocent blood. Most Christians don't believe that we need to take a heifer and shed its blood to cleanse the land or to make atonement for the land. So why is it that if we find the perpetrator of the crime, if we change from an unsolved homicide to a solved crime, why is it then we believe we have to shed blood? Why is it we have to obey those commandments in the Old Testament which talk about shedding blood and making atonement for a defiled land? Let's look at this concept of atonement and how it relates to war. What I think we'll see is if we study the Bible and what the Westminster Standards miss is that war is the shedding, it's national capital punishment. It's capital punishment on a national scale. It's atonement on a national scale. Let's look at the concept of holy war. First, let's elaborate a bit more on what we saw yesterday, the idea of blood. That blood has to be shed for the cases in those cases of what we call capital crimes because the blood of mere animals is not enough to make atonement for the land. We've got a whole list of some passages from Leviticus 20, that says that you can't go to the temple with a turtle dove or a lamb or an ox and shed the blood of that animal and have it be sufficient to make atonement for certain crimes which are so heinous the animals won't do. The perpetrator of the crime, the blood shall be upon the perpetrator. His blood has to be shed. Look at those quotations. Stop the audio file if you want to and just look at them. Their blood shall be upon them. Now look at Leviticus 18, starting at verse 24. Israelites are told, do not defile yourself with any of these things, all this long list of crimes that you have in Leviticus 17, 18, 19, 20, around there. Do not defile yourselves with these things, for by all these things the nations are defiled, which I am casting out before you. The land is defiled. Therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it, and the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgment, lest the land vomit you out also when you defile it, as it vomited out the nations that were before you. Now, literally, the land, of course, didn't vomit out the people. Actually, what happened is God sent in Israel to execute national capital punishment on them, that they were cut off from among their people. Look at Exodus 22:20, and I think we should note here also that the laws, verse 26, you shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, they weren't just for Israel, they were for all the nations. And the nations in the promised land, the Hittites and the Hivites and the Jebusites and all those different nations in the promised land violated these laws, and that's why they were vomited out by the land itself. Which really means, in practice, that Israel came in and executed national capital punishment on them, which we'll see in just a minute. But the law is for all nations. Exodus 22:20, he that sacrificeth unto any god save the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. That word utterly destroyed is not an item of military strategy. It's a religious word. It means a religious ban, a ban for utter destruction, a dedication for destruction, really a dedication for sacrifice. You can read a word, you can read about this word in a textbook called the Theological Wordbook of the Old Testament, which you'll find in every seminary. Which describes the meaning of this word. Okay, background over. Let's look at the text in the Westminster Larger Catechism, question 136, that says, except in case of lawful war. It's the sixth commandment forbids taking away life except for lawful war. There are two texts that are given by the catechism. The first is Jeremiah 48:10. The second is Deuteronomy 20 throughout, and verse 1 is cited in our edition of the Catechism. Let's look at Deuteronomy 20 first. Verse 1 says, "When thou goest out to the battle against thine enemies, and seest horses, chariots, and a people more than thou, be not afraid of them, for the Lord thy God is with thee, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt," etc. Well, let's look at the next verse. Verse 2, "So it shall be, when you are on the verge of battle, that the priest shall approach and speak to the people." Let's talk about the involvement of priests in war. Very significant in the Old Testament. War is not really what we think of as a civil function. It is certainly not exclusively, it's a priestly function. Now, one of my favorite theologians, James B. Jordan, who disagrees entirely with me on this point and agrees with the Westminster Catechism and standards that war, lawful war, is a valid exception to the Sixth Commandment. He does, however, point out that the priests had functions as warriors, and that the military in Israel was not necessarily a state function. It was more a church function. Indeed, he says, holy war was a specifically priestly function. It wasn't civil war in the civil sense, the political sense. It was a holy war and a priestly function. He says the torching of cities is to be understood as taking God's fire off from his altar and applying his holy, fiery wrath to his enemies. Thus, the torch cities were called whole burnt sacrifices in the Hebrew Old Testament, and he gives some verses. And he talks about other ways in which the army, or the host of Israel, was priestly, and there was an atonement tax, or what some people call a poll tax or a head tax, including a great theologian, R.J. Rushdoony. But Jordan argues that this atonement money of Exodus 30 was actually a priestly tax for a priestly army. So this is the nature of war in the Old Testament, and the war passages in the Old Testament are always appealed to justify war. But the important thing is here that war in the Old Testament was a whole burnt offering of cities to shed their blood to make atonement and cleanse the promised land for Israel so that they could move in and the land would be, atonement will have been made for the land. Now, next time, tomorrow, on day 124, we'll look at the second text that's in the Westminster Larger Catechism, Jeremiah 48:10, and we'll see how war operates outside of Israel. And again, we'll see it's a priestly activity which can be seen as capital punishment, to use our modern phrase, the shedding of blood, the sacrificing of people who have committed heinous sins in order to cleanse the land of the defilement that comes about from their sins. Okay, we'll see that tomorrow, 124. I'll see you tomorrow.